Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The problem of sexually transmitted diseases is a big one here in St. Louis, but it's not a new problem here. And that's the subject of a novel by St. Louis author William Stage. He'll join us a little bit later. But we begin with another major problem confronting our region and the rest of urban America, police shootings of young black males. A St. Louis University public health researcher is proposing immediate, concrete steps to stem the tide of these kinds of shootings. He published a recent paper on it in the Journal of Urban Health. Professor Keon Gilbert is Assistant Professor of Behavioral Science and Health Education at St. Louis University's College for Public Health and Social Justice. He joins me in studio. Well, this is a subject that just doesn't seem to go away. Not that it's a new subject, but it's getting a lot of attention, obviously, these days.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, sure.
I was just going to ask, in the research that you've done, is there a single reason, a single conclusion that you can come to as to why so many young black men are being shot by police?
There's no single reason at all. This sort of has been brewing for many years. And if you think back to earlier in our American history, the way that we have structured the prison industrial complex has been quite complex and quite harried in a number of ways. And in many ways, it has criminalized black men over time. And so one of the earliest things that happened after slavery was sort of the system of convict leasing, where people were arrested for small crimes like theft and things like that and imprisoned for lifelong sentences. Mm-hmm. And what happened, the prisons then leased them to former plantation owners, and then you sort of have a sort of different system of slavery that happened. Then when we think about lynchings in America as well, a number of black men were lynched for different types of accusations. A lot of it sort of sexual misconduct, rape of white women. And a large number of the people who were lynched at that time were African-American men. And now in this era, after the civil rights, one of the primary causes are policies and structures across the country that allow the stopping and frisking or pedestrian stops of citizens. And it's been a large percentage of African Americans who are stopped here in this area, in this region. I believe about 75% of the pedestrian stops are African Americans, but they're more likely to be stopped, but less likely for any sort of contraband or to be found doing anything wrong has been the result of some of those stop and frisk policies.
Is it that police are nervous when they go into high crime areas, and typically many African American neighborhoods are high crime areas? Is that they're nervous that there's a concern that they're going to be shot at themselves?
I imagine that not only being a police officer, but doing the work of policing neighborhoods that have high crime for whatever the reasons are. Certainly, we have to think about poverty as being a primary cause for crime, for violence, for a number of issues, that it's a very difficult task to do that and to have to go to these kinds of neighborhoods. So I imagine that they are fearful of their lives. And certainly that's an occupational hazard for them as well that we have to think about and address. And as a result of sort of fears, and I think also sort of the way that our society has been structured in terms of how people grow up, how people interact, when you live in segregated communities, when you live in communities that are predominantly black, predominantly white, you don't really have the social interactions with one another to really understand how people operate, how people move, and the cultural norms that exist in these environments and communities. And I think that adds to not only the fear, but even the mischaracterization that happens of people who live in high crime areas.
You know, we'll talk about your specific proposals in just a moment, but it seems to me that one of the main things that has to be talked about and has been discussed since the Michael Brown shooting is the need for better police training. I mean, what you're talking about, a lot of that could be eliminated with better training.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the idea of addressing our own biases, our own prejudices is really important in how we think about people and how we think about the work that we're all trying to do, whether you're a police officer, whether you're a politician, whether you're a public health researcher. the way that we think about communities who are in need or vulnerable populations themselves, we have to really reframe how we think about those folks. And a lot of them are poor. A lot of them are black and brown. And the way that we think about them, the way that we interact with them has to be changed. And that certainly is even more relevant for police today.
What do you make of reports such as the Ferguson Commission report and some of the things the Justice Department has done following the Michael Brown shooting with recommendations that they have had? Do you think that they are sufficient, assuming that they will be acknowledged and implemented?
I think they are sufficient in a number of ways. They're relying on the best evidence that they can gather as it relates to not only what's happened here in the St. Louis region, but in other cities where there have been similar incidents. And the number of proposals really sort of stem around thinking about how do we address these issues from a life course perspective in a number of ways. How do we make sure that communities are healthy and safe for everyone, but especially for children? I think those are really important things for us to think about and for us to resonate with, because when these incidents do happen, it becomes a public health issue. It becomes a public health threat to a number of communities, and as well as an occupational hazard for police officers.
Yeah, I'd like to just get into that a little bit. We've talked before. You were involved in the For the Sake of All report,
yes,
acknowledged here, in which public health was looked upon very, very closely as a contributing factor to so many of our social ills. But how is this? How is this police shooting of young black males a public health issue?
So first of all, it's a public health issue because people are dying, and also people are getting hurt. So not everyone dies as a result of being shot by the police. But because this is a cause of death, it's really important for us to think about what are the underlying mechanisms that lead to this particular cause of death. And the CDC has collected data on this, and it's called Death by Legal Intervention by the CDC. Other entities like criminal justice, the FBI, they may refer to these as justifiable homicides. And this basically suggests that someone is killed as the result of an interaction with a law enforcement officer or peace officer, so someone who has the legal authority to actually kill someone. And so when we think about that as a cause of death, about black males are 21 times more likely to be killed by police. And this has been – these data have been collected since about 1960, and it's been a similar pattern. Black males, regardless of their income status, are at a high risk of being shot and killed by police. And because this is happening, it's really important for us to have better data, more reliable data, and in real time in a number of ways. There was a study that came out of Harvard that suggested that these types of deaths or incidents be considered a notifiable condition where it's automatically reported by public health and medical professionals. And then that in some ways takes it out of the hands of the police officers, because right now municipal police departments are not required to report these incidents. And so whenever there's a police shooting, if medical professionals and public health professionals automatically report this kind of information, then we can have in real time what's happening on the ground.
You know, there seems to be a certain reluctance on the part of politicians on the local, state, and national level to get into this. You know, some of the things that you're proposing that we'll obviously talk about and already have to some degree are things that could be fixed or at least attended to by legislation. They're not doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a number of small and simple things that we can do. We can think about how do we train police, for sure. There's been some recent proposals by some state legislators to actually have a Fair Impartial Policing Act. I believe Jamila Nasheed and some other legislators at the state level have been thinking about how do we ensure or even find different ways to enforce ways that police, some police officers, I shouldn't say all police officers, may be racially profiling certain communities, certain individuals. And if we have policies on the books and we're enforcing those, then that's going to help in some ways. Mm-hmm. Training of police is another thing. One of the other recommendations that comes out of the paper is the idea of community review boards as well. And this puts into the hands of the community This helps to improve the relationships between community and police in a way that provides a level and a different layer of accountability.
There's something else that's taking place today which is keeping this issue very much in the public view, and that is the use of video. I mean, cell phones have changed everything with regard to this. These kinds of incidents have happened in the past but received no attention because virtually no one knew about it. It didn't make the internet or CNN or the local news. But now everybody's got a phone and capable of taking videos.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the reasons is because a lot of people didn't believe that this was actually happening. If you live in black and brown communities across the country, people who live in those communities have been talking about this for a very long time. And so thankfully to social media, we're able to capture these unfortunate events. And is in some ways, it's sort of reminiscent of what happened in the civil rights era, where people were the cameras actually captured not only these protests, but also when police would release police dogs on protesters. The world began to see what was happening, and they saw discrimination happening right in front of their very eyes.
You know, and I think of that video, it's still very clear in my mind of Bull Connor and his dogs, during the peaceful march. That really went a long way toward changing the approach to the civil rights movement in terms of the public perception of what was going on.
Absolutely. Yeah. It completely changes the context and the conversations in many different ways. And so you have these visual representations. We have audio and visual evidence of what's going on in some of these neighborhoods.
Well, we'll get back to some of your specific proposals, those we haven't, pardon me, talked about as of yet. And I'd like to invite calls from our listening audience. If you'd like to get into this conversation, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet to STL on air. My guest is Professor Keon Gilbert, Assistant Professor of Behavioral Science and Health Education at St. Louis University. He's got a series of proposals for stemming this trend of police shootings of young black males. We'll continue the conversation in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with Professor Keon Gilbert. Keon, I know you didn't do this research by yourself, but how did you research this project of yours?
So my colleague, Rayshawn Ray, who's in the Department of Sociology at the University of Maryland, around after the Mike Brown shooting, we had a lot of conversations about what was going on, as many people were. And being both African-American men, we decided that we wanted to do something about this. We wanted to use our academic voices, our academic skills and tools to be able to frame this in a way that made sense to a number of different audiences, and in particular the public health audience, because people are literally being hurt and dying. One of the issues was that there wasn't a lot of evidence to sort of suggest or support what was going on. And we wanted to write a paper that sort of summarized a number of different issues and the evidence that was available at that time.
We have a caller here who wants to get into the conversation. And with what we're talking about right now, this is the time to bring in Ron, who is calling from Ferguson. Ron, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was calling as a person who has an engineering background and some in statistics and a 20-year combat engineer officer. As I look at these issues, I was in the city, lived in the city when this became an epidemic with the murder rate across the country in the early 80s, late 80s. And we used to have a murder rate of 30,000 across the country. And I will admit that there are probably 50 to 100 police shootings that do not seem to be justified. But if I was a statistician and a policy person, I would be focusing on the 30,000, always have more of my efforts toward the 30,000 than the 50 to 100. Now, I do admit that we need more black police officers, more black prosecutors. We need a better jury system. but I do not see how in 5 years from now that his particular study will have a reduction in either one of these areas. Most of these problems deal with racism, family structure, poor schools, and lack of jobs. So we need to focus on those areas, and then most of those other problems will go away. Ferguson didn't have a shooting for 150 years. It wasn't until some small demographics with public housing came about where this particular issue, and from what I can think, from my point of view, somebody who lived there for 25 years, if I was in that position and was in an altercation with someone and I have a gun, I would be forced to shoot them because if I tripped and fell and they got my gun away from me, they would kill me.
All right, Ron, thanks for the call. I don't think you're going to disagree with much of what he said, but go ahead and respond to him.
Well, I think one of the challenges that Ron suggests is that what's going to happen if someone were to pick this up 5 years from now? Certainly this is not – these are not recommendations that are going to solve all of the issues or maybe not even prevent – in some ways prevent some of them in some ways. We hope that they'll have some impact in a number of different ways of addressing sort of the structures that exist. And also the paper talks about sort of the history and the legacy that led us to these moments. Having more reliable and in real-time data allows us to really to capture this problem and capture this issue. The Guardian, which is a United Kingdom newspaper, is collecting these data. And so in 2015 alone, over 500 people were shot and killed by police. We don't have this data really at municipal or county levels because it's just not available. People are not reporting it, of course, because it's a really difficult thing for people to want to admit. It's political, all these kinds of things. But the idea that we need to be able to better capture what's going on is extremely important, and how we then address these incidents once they occur is extremely important. And if we have policies and structures in place, then we may be able to really to have an impact and to reduce these incidents when they with these types of structures.
The discussion obviously is important because, as we indicated earlier in the program, many of the things that have been brought to light in the last year or two are conditions that have existed for a long, long time,
absolutely.
But nobody was talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, let's go through your points. You just dealt with point number one. I've got the list in front of me here. Pardon me for reading.
It's okay.
It's collect more data to establish facts of incidents and create responsible policy decisions. That is exactly what you just said a moment ago. And number two, reevaluate perception of fear as a viable defense. We kind of alluded to that before, but just explain what you mean by that.
Sure. What we mean by that is dealing with the issue of in many ways, many citizens are afraid of black communities, and in particular, they're afraid of black men. And some of it has to do with racial bias, racial prejudices, but also in the way that as a society, we have largely criminalized black men from an early age. And dealing with that issue is extremely important and extremely difficult. And we have to unpack that in a number of different ways. In many ways, as black men have been criminalized, black women have been sexualized. And so when we deal with these intersections of race, class, gender, and how that feeds into our identity or the identities that we place on people, it's really important for us to be able to deal with that, to understand that not all black men are criminals, just like we wouldn't assume that all white males are drug addicts or drug abusers. And so we have to really think about how do we characterize and mislabel certain groups.
Right. The next point, actually, I'll take the next two and combine them just for the sake of time.
Sure.
Revise stop and frisk laws. You've already mentioned that. And reconsider stand your ground laws. So here are two bodies of law that need to be addressed.
Absolutely. And so the idea that we have these policies like stop and frisk or pedestrian stops that really in some ways facilitates the interactions between police and residents. And sometimes that leads to sort of negative interactions, and it may lead to people being hurt or people being killed. We have to deal with that because in many ways when you're stopping a large number of African Americans with the idea that they're criminals, and the reality is that they're not, you're not finding them to be doing anything wrong. There's no contraband on them. You have to realize that these policies are not working. They're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, as well as it's creating these legal entrapments, like we've talked about in Ferguson and in much part of the county, the court system, how they've basically entrapped and ensnared a number of people in that process through traffic courts and things like that. And so if we can end these policies in a number of different ways, that will help better facilitate interactions between police and community.
I think stop and frisk really was brought to public attention in New York City.
Absolutely.
And they're rethinking that now, as I understand it. And, of course, the overwhelming number of people who were stopped and frisked were African American in New York, which is one of the reasons they're stopping it.
Yeah. Black men were 9 out of 10 times more likely to be stopped in New York City. Yeah.
Let's bring in Jay calling from Normandy. We'll get him in, and then we'll move on to some of your other points. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, hi, gentlemen. What's an officer supposed to do? Even that Cleveland situation, that young man, you couldn't tell exactly how old the kid was. He was carrying and pointing a weapon, and it was a weapon. It was a pellet, and it was pointed at those officers. What's an officer supposed to do in that situation? I mean, I think tactically they could have done better about getting too close. But if a weapon is pointed that looks like a gun is pointed, there was no orange tip on that weapon. What's an officer supposed to do? You can't ignore that kind of threat.
Jay, thank you for the call.
So I think in issues with Tamir Rice out of Cleveland, and in a number of different incidents, it seems that there are a number of factors that relates to sort of procedures, tactics that sort of were missteps on behalf of police officers.
Training again.
So it speaks to training in a number of different ways. And so if we can address that, then hopefully there may be better interactions. I can't say that incident would have been prevented, but hopefully it may be prevented in the future if we have better training and improved tactics and procedures and making sure people are adhering to those.
Another of your proposals is require body cams. That subject's received a lot of attention in the last year or so.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of cities are looking into the body cam issue. Obama put in about $263 million, I think about a year ago, for cities to explore this. And I think a number of municipalities are doing this. And there are a lot of challenges with implementing the body camera programs. But I think it's something that a lot of cities really need to think about. And those that have seen reductions in police shootings.
Now, my understanding is the city of St. Louis is going to start using them, but only sergeants will be
that's my
carrying
understanding
the body cams
as well.
Well, they're expensive.
Yeah.
And as you say, there are other issues, privacy issues. What do you do with all this tape? And what if the wrong tape gets out?
Who controls it?
Exactly.
All those things.
You mentioned earlier on independent civilian review boards. Why are they so important?
They're really important because it provides, I think, better communication, better accountability of police to the communities that they are there to serve. And it allows, I think, a number of different ways for community to have some input and to have a role in reviewing these types of incidents when they occur, because I think it's really important when something like this occurs in a community, the community wants to know that someone is going to do something about it and that there is a level of accountability that exists outside of the police, outside of the political structures as well.
And might be fewer declarations of justifiable homicide.
Absolutely.
Which has been the case. Fight prejudice, which is, I think, speaks in and of itself, which is fairly clear why that needs to be addressed. Mental health services. This takes us back to the public health area, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. In health services in general. And so if an incident like this occurs, it affects the mental health and well-being of that community. And we need to make sure that we have appropriate responses and structures in place to address those mental health needs of communities that have been affected by police shootings.
We have a couple of emails and tweets here I'll read to you and you can respond. Bob writes, pardon me, until blacks and their communities get the support they deserve, which will break the cycle of violence and gang allegiance, the violence will continue. Yes, help police understand the communities they are patrolling. More important, find people jobs, which will give them self-esteem and respect. Teens join gangs because they see no future. We need to give them that future.
I agree.
The gang issue is something we haven't talked about, but that's a big part of the problem, too, where gangs are active. Police are afraid of them. There's a lot of firepower amongst these kids sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Gangs are very interesting in a number of different ways, and they're present in all sorts of forms. They're social networks at the core. They're forms of social support. They're structures for social support for a lot of communities. And whether you're in a white neighborhood, whether you're in a Latino neighborhood or a black neighborhood, gangs exist all across. We may call them something different depending on what neighborhood we're talking about.
A final tweet here from Aaron, who writes, institutional racism has never seemed as bad as it is today and so blatant. Does Donald Trump feed into this? Racists seem to be bolstered in today's culture. Is society fatigued with police murders to the point people believe cops are always right? Well, you want to get into the politics of this?
That may be another show, Don.
it may be. But there does seem to be a chorus out there. The volume has been turned up on issues such as this, not always to the positive.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of the current candidates have been forced to, in their own way, address this or to discuss it or felt forced to mention it. But I don't think not all of them have the right information in terms of what they might do or propose to address this particular issue. And it's really important for studies like this and other studies that have been coming out over the last year or so to provide evidence and provide sort of in many ways strategies and opportunities for us to rethink how we're going to think about and do something about this particular issue.
We've got to wrap this up, Keon. What do you want folks to take away from this conversation?
One is really just making sure that the larger audience, the larger community, whether it's academic or lay, understand that this is an important issue that we have to continue to talk about. And until we find the right structures, the right policies, the right practices to deal with this, to make sure that we have less shootings and killings by police, as well as to making sure that we protect police from the occupational hazards of feeling the fear and threat of being killed, then we're going to continue to have this conversation. And so hopefully in a year it will be a different conversation if many municipalities do something about it.
Well, you've presented a blueprint, you and your colleague, for things to consider and discuss. Thank you so much for that, Keon Gilbert, Assistant Professor of Behavioral Science and Health Education at St. Louis University. When we come back, I'll look at another big urban problem, sexually transmitted disease, as seen by a novelist who learned about it firsthand right here in St. Louis. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you.